Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Spring allergies will make their usual appearance this year, but with temperatures in the high 60s in February, when they arrive and how long they hang out may be changing. Dr. Leonard Bielerai is a specialist in allergy and immunology at Rutgers Center of Environmental Prediction. He studies the impact of climate change on allergies and joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
When we're talking about all of this and we say climate change, are we talking about, you know, it could be a regular old winter next year. What are we talking about?
Well, let's go into the definition. You know, the weather is the day-to-day variation of what occurs. It could be raining today or snowing, depends where you are. And climate is the change of weather over time, whether you consider that a decade, a century or a millennium. I mean, that's climate. And climate does change. And so that's the concern. Whether or not what's the cause of climate change,
We're not going there today.
We're not going there. But you know, weather is, you know, this is what it is. This year, you have in the Ohio Valley, River Valley, have experiencing unseasonably mild conditions, as well as some areas where I am. And I actually have data for your area that I've been analyzing for the past several years, reflecting the earlier pollen release, which will occur this year. So people will have exposure to pollen seen already, which is mid-February, which normally should come about the first or second week in March.
So this is pretty significant. That's a big change.
Well, it's a change for this year.
Yeah.
It's 4 weeks earlier, you'll see. But you could have a snowstorm in the next week, and it will obliterate the pollen exposure. But the sensitization is already occurring, meaning people may be starting to suffer mild. Usually, individuals who are quite sensitive will start feeling it, meaning the best pollen counting device is one's eyes and nose.
Mm-hmm.
Right now it's predominantly trees that is pollinating, and it could be a certain species of trees, such as we will say elm, cedar. We'll soon see ash. But you know, the highest pollinators, the ones that really release tremendous loads of pollen, are the oak and birch species. And that does not occur until late April, beginning of May.
All things being equal?
All things being equal. This year we may actually see birch and oak pollinating the last week in March or first week in April, which will show an increase in exposure. The longer you're exposed to a pollen that you're allergic to, the more likely that you will develop symptoms that will be more protracted, which you will need medications or some other intervention.
And so the earlier the pollens appear, does it mean they're going to go away sooner? That's the longer they stay.
Correct. It does not mean that they shut down earlier. It's an earlier onset, and usually the time of dissipation of pollination usually stays about the same, again, depending upon the weather conditions at the time.
I was kind of thinking about, we have a really rough flu season. We're going to be talking about that later in the program. And that combined with allergies, I was kind of wondering if that they exacerbate each other.
Well, one does promote the other, but there are clinical differences between
yes.
the two. A viral infection, such as the flu, it gives you muscle aches and pains and a persistent fever that occurs from the virus causing an immune response. The allergy also causes an immune response, but it's an allergic one, and you rarely get a temperature or muscle aches and pains. So therefore, there is one differentiating point.
Mm-hmm.
The other differentiating points that you get by symptoms between muscle aches and pains is that the symptoms of allergy seem to persist for weeks, whereas the viral infection, you have a peak within 24 to 48 hours or 72 hours, and then after that, you kind of start getting better, but you may have a persistent cough, a runny nose, but you're not feeling the muscle aches and pains consistent with a systemic viral exposure.
How do you measure all of this when it comes to pollen counts and things like that? What are you studying?
We're studying the pollen counts. I was funded by the United States EPA to evaluate climate change allergic airway disease. And I had access to the pollen data from the National Allergy Bureau, which are an independent group of allergists, predominantly individuals who do the pollen counts throughout the country. There are over 80 stations, but even with those 80 stations, there are a lot of areas that we don't cover with such great granularity. So toward that goal, there is an interest that I've been pursuing is the development of an automated pollen detection devices where we'll give a more granularity to actually knowing what's in the air in your area, in your around your house, which is an important feature. And if people would like to know more about it, I definitely would like to would love to have them do a survey and their interest in how they would like to use such pollen data, because there is no real system at this point in time. In your location in the Ohio River Valley, you have Louisville, a pollen counting station. You have Dayton, Ohio, Bloomington, Indiana. You have a variety of pollen count stations around there, about 7 or 8 of them. But you cover a large territory with this radio transmission for National Public Radio. So, you know, it's not as granular. So what is really in my area? But usually the biomes, the type of trees that are in one area are consistent. But if you're on higher elevation in the Appalachians or if you're in the lower elevations, there are differences, clearly. And one wants to know what's in their own hometown, so to speak.
Do they differ that much?
Yes. I mean, clearly, if you would look at pollination, I mean, clearly, if you're in southeast United States, you would already see blooming flowers. And by the way, you're not allergic to flowers. Flowers are pollinated by insects and animals, whereas what we're thinking about are the trees, grasses, and weeds that are pollinated by the wind, which carries in the wind, and that's why the best pollen counting device is literally your eyes and nose.
Mm-hmm.
And though there are these devices called rotarods, Burkhards, which are spore traps, which we can measure the amount of deposition, the pollen count that you actually are seeing that you hear about is really for the past 24 hours. It's not real time. You may hear something called a pollen dot an index.
Mm-hmm.
Pollen index is a farmer's almanac of past history. It's not the real pollen count. It is not, you know, it doesn't really tell you what's in the air now based upon real pollen counts. It's telling you what should be in the air at this point in time. We did a study comparing pollen index versus pollen counts, and interesting enough, they were 50% of the time discordant. They were not giving you the right information. And in fact, in one city where there is a single pollen index, there were two pollen count stations having two different pollen counts. So it's an example that, you know, people have to be careful. But it gives you a general farmer's almanac type of information at this point in time.
Research data suggests that the prevalence of asthma, including forms of the disease triggered by pollen, mold, and other substances, is on the rise. Does this have anything to do with climate change?
Well, let's put it this way. That has to be one of the variables that needs to be included in the assessment. With climate change, meaning with weather changes and having a longer exposure, for example, this year, if it remains warm for the next 3 or 4 weeks in the Ohio River Valley, you're going to have more people sensitized to trees. And next year, so their symptoms will be noted next year. Now, as pollen is a common trigger, 90% of asthmatics, especially in children, are triggered by allergens such as pollen. But it is not hyperacute. It's not like the pollen count today is causing asthma today.
Mm-hmm.
As I try to explain to individuals, when you're stung by a bee in the garden, you're working on the garden on Sunday, and you're stung by a bee, you have an immediate reaction. And that immediate could be toxic, meaning just local, or it could be systemic, meaning you may start shortness of breath, runny nose, watery eyes. You may even get what we call anaphylaxis. That's an immediate response. However, if you now, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, you start developing a rash, that is a delayed reaction, but that's probably the poison ivy. But people call poison ivy an allergy as well. Asthma is more like poison ivy, where if you're chronically exposed to some irritants, you will get progressive irritation or inflammation in your airways that will eventually lead to symptoms once you reach a certain critical level. Why is it that a person who walks into a house with a cat and are allergic to cats get asthma right away?
Yeah.
Well, that's because they're already primed. They're ready to go. And they have severe allergies to cat, such that a small amount, just a small amount, is ever the trigger. And in fact, people should know regarding, for example, I use an indoor allergen like cat. Even though the cat's not in the house for the past 4 months, the allergen is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a hard. Whereas pollen, it gets incredibly high, and you'll get sniffly, watery eyes usually the first day, and then you'll start developing a post-nasal drip and a cough. 8% of asthmatics don't wheeze. They cough. And so that cough is a sign of worsening asthma, of underlying bronchospasm in many patients.
Do the properties of pollen change with climate change? In other words, if pollen's coming out now, like it probably is in central Ohio right now, and we're going to get up to the 70s by Friday, does it change the property of the pollen? Does it make it worse pollen, or is it just the same pollen, it's just around for longer? Do we know anything about that?
That's an excellent question, and sure enough, it's part of the USDA grant, the EPA grant. We're growing various species of weeds and grasses under different concentrations of CO2, and the answer to that is that the pollen does change in the character. The question is allergen content. How much allergen does it increase? And there are some studies that suggest that it does, that you can change or increase the amount of allergen in one grain of pollen. It does change with time on exposure to a variety of pollutants or climate change greenhouse gases. Now, but that's interesting. Plants can change from year to year. They actually have the ability not to fully mutate, but to respond to the environment with different characteristics, of which pollen is one of them.
If people who are very allergic to these pollens that are coming out now and that are going to be around for a while, if there's not the usual blizzard in April kind of a thing, is there a way to prepare for that? Is there something they should be doing now to prepare?
Well, I do advise individuals, Ben Franklin is, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Right.
It's still a very important treatment concept, and it's very true. I mean, for diabetics, if you can lose weight, that's a pound of prevention, literally a pound,
mm-hmm.
And that will be worth a kilogram of cure. Where it comes to allergies, if you know you have asthma and you know your allergies are from trees, we can go see your allergist. He's going to give you an action plan that will probably increase your medication in preparation so you don't break through, you don't get that cough, that post-nasal drip, whether or not immunotherapy, the famous use of the allergy shots, there are now oral immunotherapy therapeutic regimens for specifically their grasses, for ragweed, there are, so you can actually not get the shot and get away with just taking an oral allergen treatment regimen. The immunotherapy still seems to be the standard of care, and it probably provides the most polysensitized. People are rarely allergic just to a single tree or just to a single grass. They're allergic to grasses, trees, and a few weeds. So therefore, it's hard to do the oral immunotherapy route, but they can be explored. The immunotherapy does modulate the immune system and makes you more tolerant of exposure. Usually, if you undergo a proper regimen treatment with immunotherapy, the quote-unquote allergy shots, you can be exposed to 10 times to 100 times more of that allergen and not respond as rigorous as you did in the past.
On the other side of the coin, there are people like me who are allergic to leaf mold. And there was a really long leaf mold season because it was a very warm fall. Is that something that's being studied as well?
Yes, absolutely. The problem with molds is that its mold spores are released, and they're commonly seen when, quote, like you said, at the end of the season. When ragweed dies with the first frost, then mold spores are released because frost actually stimulates mold spores to be released because it's its dying day, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But then it gets warm again. But the pollen release from the ragweed is over, but the mold is now being digested. It's like mulch.
Yeah.
It's creating itself, its own environment to produce more mold, and then it will release it. And that gives you perennial allergens, especially in the home, mold spores. But clearly, mold spores are, we're seeing that already in our pollen assessments of our New Jersey area. My pollen counts are probably have the impact of northern New Jersey and clearly of New York City, because pollen travel and mold spores travel. It's the same biome, and it travels 50 to several hundred miles from their sources. The higher the tree, the higher the dispersal. However, grass pollen is low-lying, so it travels 100 feet, 10 feet, 2 feet to 100 feet. It gets a little bloom of the pollen release, whereas the trees, in New Jersey, the Delaware Water Graph, which borders Pennsylvania and New Jersey, can release pollen in that area that reaches New York City. We've also been evaluating sea breeze and found that the sea breeze from the Jersey coast will reach Philadelphia, which is on the Delaware River. And that's, we're talking about, 60 to 100 miles, a large distance of travel. So in that regard, yes, the mold spores are significant. They are seen throughout the winter because of those forming spells. As soon as it warms up, that moldy areas do release their mold spores, and people do get mild symptoms. Rarely do they get a severe outbreak unless it's persistent and chronic over time.
Right. Well, Dr. Leonard Bielari, I should say, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
I hope it was helpful for your listeners.
Dr. Bielari is a specialist in allergy and immunology with the Rutgers Center of Environmental Prediction and a physician at the Robert Wood Johnson University Hospital. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Wearable fitness trackers are everywhere these days, and insurance companies are starting to notice. Last month, UnitedHealthcare launched an offer to customers and giving them the opportunity to earn cash by wearing a Fitbit tracker and then sharing the data with the insurer. It sounds like a win-win, but some say customers may be getting more than they bargained for. Biomedical and Health Information Sciences professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago, Dr. Andrew Boyd, wrote about it recently on The Conversation. We have a link to his article on our website at wosu.org/allsides. And Dr. Boyd joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me to the show.
Roughly 1 in 5 Americans use a fitness tracker, according to health professionals. What's the consensus about how good they are for your health in the first place?
The actual wellness for your health or how you actually improve them, it depends on how you use them. Obviously, if you use it to help motivate yourself, increase the amount of activity, increase the amount of exercise, or they can have a positive impact. However, as shown in some of the articles, they don't always. It is not a magic pill. It is not a magical device. If you don't actually walk or do activities, the device itself doesn't help you burn calories. The device itself doesn't make you do the changes to your behavior. The patient and the consumer have to do these things.
You write that wearing a fitness tracker like a Fitbit could earn people cash with their health insurance companies. How does that work? What's the model there?
The model with that Fitbit and UnitedHealthcare Insurance talked about, it's not cash. It's credit in your health savings account. So it's not like you can go off and buy a six-pack of beer with it, but for high-deductible insurance plans or when you go to a visit, you can use the money for that. So it's not from that point of view. So the way the wellness programs do is, in order to get the incentive, you sign up and you voluntarily participate and you share data with the insurance company more than you would normally with an insurance company. Historically, it's been lab values. Historically, it's been, do you promise to quit smoking? Do you sign up for a gym? What this wellness program is unique for, it's directly tied to an activity tracker. And specifically in this one, it is tied to a Fitbit data. And so the benefit to the individual is if you adhere to all of the wellness goals, you can earn up to $1,500 in cash or credits in your health savings account, which will help defer the co-pays for medicine, will help defer the co-pays for a number of different things. So if the goal is to help motivate individuals, you can motivate individuals, make them more active, and help partner with the insurance company to make you healthier. Yes, it can be good, or a win-win between the two of you. The challenge, though, is the potential repeal of Obamacare and the change of insurance rules nationwide.
Why is that?
Well, one of the caveats within the Affordable Care Act, or as Obamacare is called, was it's currently illegal to deny people health insurance or increase their rates based on pre-existing conditions. Before the ACA or Obamacare was passed, insurance companies could say, hey, what health conditions do you have? Did you have them before? And either they could deny you coverage for asthma or diabetes or pregnancy if you were already a few months into a pregnancy and you signed up in the middle of an illness, they wouldn't cover you, or they could deny you, or they could increase your rates. Mm-hmm. With the Affordable Care Act, Congress passed a law saying insurance companies have to take everyone. They can't increase the rates. They can't decrease the rates. They can't deny you. However, if Obamacare is repealed, which the Republicans tried to do dozens of times before President Trump was elected, and currently, if you listen to the news reports, they have multiple drafts circulating around that Trump has campaigned on and promised to repeal, we didn't have fitness trackers 8 years ago. Could insurance companies use fitness trackers to get a better risk profile of you and help determine what the rate is if they allow pre-existing conditions to price your insurance? And that's the concern I raised. Currently, today, it is illegal. But with Republican Congress and Senate and President, they are all promising a repeal of Obamacare. This should be something we are talking about. Can you use your own Fitbit data to price insurance?
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and my guest, Dr. Andrew Boyd, just laid it out there. Should we be using our Fitbits to price insurance? He's an assistant professor in the Department of Biomedical and Health Information Sciences at the University of Illinois in Chicago. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So let's just take the insurance company. Let's say Obamacare is abolished and we return to the system where they could deny or change rates based on existing conditions. You're saying that they could, it's ostensible, it's possible that they could force us to wear these fitness trackers to determine eligibility.
I'm not saying it currently.
No, it's not currently. Yeah.
No. Currently, the program that UnitedHealthcare and Fitbit says it's voluntary.
Right.
They're giving you money in order to participate. However, with multiple other insurance programs, what starts out as voluntary in 5 or 6 years becomes mandatory. And so what we're talking about is with the repeal, instead of forcing you to wear it, they might actually say, hey, have you worn a Fitbit device in the last 3 to 5 years?
Mm.
And from the point of view of if you're wearing a Fitbit device, as you said, a large percentage of the population is wearing a Fitbit device today, they could say in 3 to 5 years, oh, just let us talk to Fitbit, Jawbone, any other activity tracker. We'll pull in your data that you're collecting today and use that to build a risk profile for you. But you would then have to give consent in order to have them pull that data. But again, when you're applying for health insurance, you usually say, I have to agree to a physical exam, I have to agree to lab tests. When you're buying on the individual marketplace, there's a number of things that you could opt out of, but if you don't, they say, oh, we want voluntarily want you to give some blood so we know your blood values to price you appropriately. Well, if you don't give them the blood, you don't get the insurance. So this won't be compelling wearing the device, but the devices you're wearing today could be used in the future to help either price or just get a better idea of what your physical activity status is. And because the insurance applications are very complex and because individuals don't realize the data we collect today could be used for us and against us in the future because of these changes, these are things people need to think about before they sign up for the wellness programs and before, and as well as on a national level, when we're talking about how, what is the appropriate way if we do allow pre-existing conditions to be used, what can you use and what can't you use? This is new information.
Right. What kind of data is United Health taking now from it in this voluntary program? What are they looking at? Just your heart rate and how many steps you walk a day or what?
Yes, the Fitbit data or the activity trackers they're currently used now only measure the steps you day and your heart rate.
Okay.
And so from the point of view of it's not like this device has 22 sensors on you and collects a whole bunch of data. But my area of research is looking at data for secondary analysis. So if they have hundreds of thousands of people sign up for this wellness plan, which hopefully if we can get people well and encourage activity, yes, that would be a great benefit. But if you have hundreds of thousands of people with heart rate and steps with all of their diagnosis, do they have diabetes? Do they have asthma? Do they have pancreatic cancer? When you're looking at thousands of patients, it may not be clinically relevant, but can you find correlations or can you find signature profiles in the data they're currently collecting? And what the fitness tracker in United Healthcare Wellness Program is starting is the insurance company's first ability to look at, on a national basis, your clinical conditions with what your Fitbit data is currently tracking. So right now, they're only tracking a minimum number of variables. But the other thing you have to keep in mind as well, Qualcomm is about to announce next quarter the basically the X Prize, or the successful company that's built the tricorder that is hopefully going to be able to diagnose 13 different devices and keeps track of several more variables than the current Fitbit technology. So what we talk about, like devices diagnosing you remotely, the more data we collect, the more we can understand you, isn't that far away. They're about to award a prize of $10 million for a company that's done this. So the question is, with the data we have now, plus all of your clinical data, what are the insurance companies going to use it for? If the insurance companies are using it to improve your health, you're for it, I'm for it, we're all for it. The question is, as the insurance rules change, if they're going to use it to price us, we just need to be aware of this. Or there are several other things we have told the insurance companies. It's illegal for you to use this type of data, like genetic data, to discriminate against health insurance because you don't have control over it. Will we give the same sort of protection to Fitbit data?
What's Fitbit getting out of this deal? We're focusing on Fitbit because that's the company that United Healthcare is contracted with, right?
Yes. What Fitbit is getting an increased number of users. If you've seen over the last, I believe, two quarters, the number of people who are using activity trackers has sort of leveled out. The initial users, the initial uptakes, that has sort of been saturated. And so what Fitbit is getting is an increased customer pool or increased patient pool, depending on the way you look at it, as well as engagement into the clinical care system. I really believe fitness tracking devices have a great promise in engaging patients. in specific clinical conditions, such as post-surgery recovery. If you had a hip replacement and you need to be walking in order to help build up strength, having a fitness tracker post-surgical recovery and monitoring how many steps you're taking in order to see if all of a sudden you're starting to drop off, that could be an initial indication of a pending infection. Or maybe there's new ways of engaging for weight loss or new ways of engaging for a whole host of different health conditions. So the activity trackers we haven't quite figured out where they're going to be best helped, but when the insurance companies are using it, they're not just trying to improve outcomes, they're also trying to understand risk as well as appropriately priced health insurance. And while it's illegal today, with the pending repeal of Obamacare, how are they going to use this data in the future?
Well, is this something that has been discussed at the policy level?
I have not seen any reports of this in the lay press.
Go ahead.
I have not seen any reports.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, that's okay. What kind of feedback have you received from your article that you wrote about that? What are people saying?
The responses I've seen have been all in all positive. Some people had also been thinking about how currently auto insurance, some insurance companies are giving you a little device to plug into your car to see if you're a safe or an aggressive driver. And they use the same example of, oh, auto insurance is already going this way. We could do the same thing in health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have been very positive. We've had some people talk to us just trying to make sure that we were completely accurate in our description of what is currently available with the technology as well as what is possible in the future. So we've had some positive responses. We've had some people who did not think fitness trackers are going to have any positive benefit either. So, again, it's a mix of responses. Mm-hmm. But, again, go ahead.
Well, I think it's really interesting what you've kind of alerted me to is the fact that even if I don't use my Jawbone anymore because it wouldn't fit my wrist, but that data is still out there.
And that's one of the things with the new technology. The data will exist in perpetuity. And even if United Healthcare, even if Fitbit promise never to sell your data, even if they promise never to merge it with your insurance data, the challenge is we're still in the initial phases. As soon as one of these companies go bankrupt, it's not the licensing agreement that they promise never to sell your data. It's the bankruptcy court that's going to determine what the value and what you're going to do with the data in order to return the money to the creditors. We are so new in this area. It's one of those challenges. Even if a company promises you not to sell their data, if they go under, I hope to live longer for another 20 to 40 years. We haven't had these companies last 20 to 40 years. The insurance companies have, so that's a good sign. But many of these activity tracking companies haven't. We're still in the beginning stages. So this data will be around. Whether or not it's linked to your name is a different question. Whether or not it's linked to your medical records, different question. But this data, we're collecting this data for one purpose. The question we need to be thinking about is, are there appropriate uses or are there appropriate protections for this type of data that we want to think about?
Dr. Andrew Boyd, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Dr. Andrew Boyd is an assistant professor in the Department of Biomedical and Health Information Sciences at the University of Illinois in Chicago. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. According to the State Department of Health, 4 Ohio children have died of influenza over the past 3 weeks, and the number of cases is growing across the state and the country. We're talking about common seasonal viruses and how to detect the symptoms early today. Joining us is the medical director and assistant health commissioner of Columbus Public Health, Dr. Mashika Roberts. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Why is the flu particularly dangerous for young children and older adults again?
So every year we talk about the flu virus and we talk about certain populations that are more susceptible to not only getting the flu, but some of the complications of the flu. And our very young children and our older adults are always in that group. And because usually their immune systems are weaker than the general population, they have more fragile illnesses. And something like the flu can just tip them over and require more medical attention, more medical care, and often hospitalization if they get the flu.
How bad is it this year? We've gotten a couple press releases from your department, which kind of sort of put me on notice a little bit that, hey, it's not good.
Yeah, the last few weeks have been pretty bad for Franklin County as well as for the state and the nation as a whole. So this year, the flu season has been pretty severe, and it's likely because one of the more prominent strains is influenza A, particularly influenza H3N2, which is a very virulent form of influenza, and it causes a lot of illness when it is circulating. And so that's why we see, unfortunately, some of the pediatric deaths we've seen here in Ohio, and we've seen an increase in hospitalizations here. So already this year, and we're not even done with the flu season, we've already surpassed the number of hospitalizations we saw last season with the influenza virus. So it's a bad season.
What is the season for flu? What is it typically?
Yeah, that's a good question. So typically we say that flu is in the winter months. So we usually start counting flu cases as early as October, and we go until April, sometimes even May. And usually that corresponds, at least in our neck of the woods here in Ohio, with a colder temperature. It's not so the case this year. We've had this off and on warm spells. But generally, the flu season in North America, here in the United States, is in the winter months, the cooler, colder months.
Is it the temperature that's the function there?
Yeah, so the temperature is the function. We know that the flu virus is a hardy virus, and it's hardier when the temperatures are cold. And the flu virus is circulated in the air, so it needs cold temperature and low humidity. And that's how it can circulate and stay in the air for longer periods of time.
It's definitely been a low humidity winter.
Yes, it has been.
Yeah.
But it hasn't really been cold here. We've had off and on spells.
Right. What's the definition of a flu now? A lot of people think they say stomach flu or, you know, the other kind of flu, the cold flu.
So, you know, the layman's terms are, you know, I have the flu or I have the stomach flu or I have a cold. And those are three different illnesses in the medical and the healthcare world. So influenza or the flu is a respiratory illness. It's usually an upper respiratory illness. It's caused by the influenza virus. And usually the hallmark sign of that is an elevated temperature or fever and body aches. And usually if you have the flu, you know it. You are out. You don't feel like getting up. You don't feel like doing anything. You don't even feel like going to work or even enjoying life, watching TV and things of that nature. So with the flu, influenza, you can have the body aches, the fever. You can have a headache. You can have chills. You could have some nausea and diarrhea and vomiting, but mostly you're having the upper respiratory symptoms. With a cold, which is also an upper respiratory illness, you usually have a stuffy, runny nose. You usually feel well enough to do some activities. You might have a mild headache. You could have some body aches, but you're well enough to, you know, try to eat, try to get around, try to go to work or other places where you could potentially be spreading the illness and exposing others. And then the stomach flu is really completely different. It's a gastrointestinal virus that usually causes nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. You can get some body aches. It's usually short-lived, 1 to 3 days, and you usually have onset of symptoms within 12 to 48 hours of exposure. You can get it from touching a contaminated object. You can get it from food if someone who prepared your food had the virus. The stomach flu or the norovirus, like we like to call it, is highly contagious. So you just need a little bit of the virus for one to get ill.
And how long does that hang on?
The norovirus, usually the symptoms last for 1 to 3 days in a person, but contaminated objects can last that long as well. So it's important if you have someone in your household who has the norovirus that if at all possible, you try to seclude them to a different bathroom than the rest of the family and you thoroughly clean the bathroom.
Is there any way to tell the difference between norovirus and food poisoning?
Oh, that's an excellent question. That would be difficult to do without some type of laboratory confirmation. You know, the one big thing is the quickness, the onset of the illness. Others who consume the same food as you, did they get sick as well? But they often display and show up very similar to each other.
When I've had the flu before, it was always I was fine. And then all of a sudden something went click.
Mm-hmm.
It's the weirdest feeling where I'm just sitting there. Everything's fine. And then clink,
yeah,
it changes, and then it gets really bad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it gets really, really bad. But why does it happen that way? Do we know?
Yeah.
Is that typical? Or
that is very typical.
Okay.
People who have the flu say, you know, I wasn't feeling great, and then all of a sudden just hit me.
Boom.
Like I was hit by a truck, you know, and I was out. It's the virus. That's how the virus is at attacking our body.
Can the flu shot give you the flu? In other words, before we say that, there's still time to get a flu shot.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
It still works.
Where it's only February. I know we're almost halfway through February.
Feels like April.
It does feel like April outside, but, you know, the forecasters tell us we will get a real winter at some point here in Franklin County. So it's not too late to get the flu vaccine. It's available at your medical provider's office, at retail outlets, and I highly encourage individuals who have not been vaccinated against the flu this season that they get the flu vaccine. The virus that's going around is making people very ill, and even those people who are getting, who have received the flu vaccine are getting ill, but their duration of their symptoms are much shorter than those who have not been vaccinated.
Okay, so the flu shot doesn't give you the flu. It just makes you, it if you're going to get it, it makes it lesser.
Absolutely. So the flu vaccine protects you from getting the flu virus. Some people feel that once they get the flu vaccine, they feel a little achy for 24 hours or so after getting the vaccine. That is your body responding to the vaccine saying, I recognize that something has been introduced, some virus has been introduced, and I'm mounting up the response if I see it again. The vaccine you get is inactivated, so it's not a live virus, so it can't give you the actual flu. Could it make your arm sore? Yes, it could. Could it make you feel a little achy for a brief period of time, like 24 hours? Yes, it can, but it does not give you the flu. And for anyone who's ever had the flu, they know there's a big difference between a 24-hour little body ache than 4 to 5 days of the flu laid out on the couch.
If people who don't have insurance, don't have any money, is there a way to get a flu shot?
Absolutely. So at the health department at Columbus Public Health, we offer the flu vaccine to everyone, regardless of their ability to pay.
Okay, so you just have to show up there.
Just show
and
up.
You can get it.
Mm-hmm. We'll ask you a few questions, but if you qualify, then you would get the vaccine with no problem.
As far as when it comes to children, they need a flu vaccine as well.
Mm-hmm.
Is it harder to tell when a kid's coming down with something than it is yourself?
So the vaccine is recommended for all individuals 6 months of age or older. And I would say, you know, the difference between children and trying to recognize is it a flu or the cold is just trying to elicit responses from the kids of how they really feel. Obviously, as I said, kids are more vulnerable, especially to this H3N2. So individuals or kids who have underlying health conditions, whether that's any cardiac or heart problems, whether it's any asthma or any respiratory illnesses, those you should, you know, have extreme caution if they have any symptoms whatsoever and seek medical attention, call your doctor, go to your urgent care, or go see your doctor if you're concerned at all. Again, it's just trying to elicit that history from the kids. How bad do you feel? And usually, if you know the kid, you know they're feeling bad based on their behavior and their activities.
We were talking earlier about allergies and the allergy season, particularly in a year like this, gets pushed ahead, which makes it longer. And I'm wondering if that creates or exacerbates flu symptoms?
Well, so the allergies will definitely exacerbate people who have underlying health conditions. So our young children, as well as adults with asthma, anyone with fragile lung disease like COPD, the allergies, a combination with the viruses circulating, could be a pretty hectic time of year for them as they deal with different health issues and respiratory issues. Mm.
Another common virus for children is Coxsackie. It's sometimes called hand, foot, and mouth disease. What is that, and why is it a bigger deal in the winter?
So, again, it's spread in the winter months because it's colder and people are usually inside and touching things. It's usually seen in children under the age of 5. Sometimes we see it in older children and adults, but usually it's children under the age of 5. And the symptoms usually are fever, mouth sores, and a skin rash. That's mm-hmm. the hallmark signs of hand, foot, and mouth disease. And, yeah, we usually do see it more in the winter childcare settings and things of that nature.
Checking for a fever is one of the first steps that people take, and I wanted to talk about what the different levels are and when you should be worried. Now, a lot of older people often have below normal temperatures mm-hmm. sometimes. Mm-hmm. I've only had a fever a couple times in my whole life, both times with the flu.
Mm-hmm.
What is dangerous?
So the danger level, again, often depends on individuals and their underlying health disease. So fever can be attributed to a number of different things. More than 50% of the time, it usually is some type of infection. It could be a virus. It could be a bacterial infection. But you can also get fever from a variety of other diseases like autoimmune disease, cancer, as well as sometimes even after a vaccine. And oftentimes, illicit drugs can cause a fever. Mm. But depending on the age of the person is what the temperature is really based on. So if you have a child under the age of 6 months, any temperature above 100.4 or 100.4 or higher is really a telltale sign that you need to seek medical attention. And again, you should tailor that to the child. If you have a child that has who was maybe born prematurely and has underdeveloped lungs or things like that, your doctor might give you a different temperature range for you to call and seek medical attention. Usually adults, we think anything above 102, 103 is where we need to get concerned. And obviously, if you have any elevation in temperature and people start to become lethargic or disoriented, no matter what the temperature is, you should seek medical attention at that point.
Does what causes fevers? Is it the immune system again?
Yeah, it's the immune system and the cytokines in your body reacting. Yes.
And if you think you have the flu, should you go see a doctor? Should you go get it treated? Or did you just go to bed and drink plenty of fluids and just the only thing you do is get over it?
So if you suspect or think or wonder if you have the flu and you have a primary care doctor, absolutely, I think you should. You might find that if you have a relationship with your doctor or if they're really busy, they might say, you know, based on your symptoms, it sounds like you have the flu. Stay home, rest, drink fluids. If your symptoms get worse, you know, seek emergency care visits or an urgent care. If you can get to the doctor within that 48 hours of the symptoms starting, they can give you an antiviral medication that can try to help reduce the length of the symptoms. But if you have any underlying health condition, if you don't feel well, if you can't keep water down or fluids down, you should seek medical attention because many people with the flu, they get dehydrated because they aren't able to keep fluids down, which can cause them to need medical attention. They can get a lung infection like pneumonia, so they would need medical attention. So if you have any question or doubt, seek medical attention and let that medical provider guide you on what's the next step.
Do you notice any difference in how people are responding to things like flu symptoms and that sort of thing when it comes to seeking help now that there's insurance?
That's an excellent question, and I don't know if I have enough information or mm-hmm. data to really state that. I think, you know, there's a possibility that people are. We look at hospitalizations, and obviously if you're really sick, you're going to go to the hospital whether you have insurance or not. I would say based on the information we gather, I don't have enough information to say whether the Affordable Care Act is bringing more people in for flu symptoms than it was before it was in place.
And in your experience, we only have a few seconds left, but in your experience, who are the people that are least likely to seek attention when they need it?
So your young, healthy adults, you know, the 25 to 40-year-olds who think they can withstand anything, who have no underlying medical conditions, those are the ones who think, I can do this, I'm fine, I'll just brave through it. Those are the ones who are least likely to seek medical attention. And I would probably raise that from, you know, your 20-year-olds to your 50-year-olds.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, Dr. Mashiga Roberts, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about the flu.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Have a healthy day.
You too. Dr. Mashiga Roberts, Medical Director and Assistant Health Commissioner at Columbus Public Health. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.